This is Fresh Air. Seven very articulate, insightful women discuss their own experiences with manic depression, psychosis, self-mutilation, and multiple personality in the new movie Dialogues with Mad Women. One of the women who recounts her story is the film's director, Ali Light. She committed herself 30 years ago during a blinding depression. She spent 3 months on the day ward of a San Francisco hospital. Dialogues with Mad Women won the Freedom of Expression Award at the Sundance Film Festival. Light's previous documentary, In the Shadow of the Stars, won an Academy Award. She made both films with her partner, Irving Saraf. Dialogues will be shown tomorrow night at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Next month, it opens theatrically in 30 cities. Light told me about the depression 30 years ago that eventually led to her new film.
I was a young mother, 28 years old. I had 3 children under the age of 6. And I was gradually beginning to think that my life was over. And now I realize that I was sinking into depression, and it wasn't a fast thing. It was a slow thing. My husband had been going to school for many years, and he had, even though he was struggling very hard, and he ultimately ended up taking care of me and the kids and doing his beginning teaching, I still felt that he was having the one who was having the adventures, and I was the one who was standing at the door every day saying goodbye, and this person was going out into the world, and I felt that that wasn't happening to me, and I didn't think it would ever happen.
In your film, you say that when you got really depressed, you were afraid you might hurt yourself or your children.
Yes.
When did you decide, well, I'm going to go to the hospital, maybe the hospital can do something for me?
Well, I was in therapy, and the first thing that happened is that the therapist, on an outpatient basis, put me on some very heavy-duty kinds of medication, which further intensified the depression. First thing was Stelazine, and then he tried some antidepressants, which were just new on the market. And they all made me feel stranger and more disjointed and more detached from myself. And as that happened, as that began to happen, I sort of lost control, what control I had left. And it was his suggestion then that I go in the hospital. But of course, I signed myself in.
When you first committed yourself, there was a psychiatrist who I can sense from your movie you didn't think very highly of. And he asked you a very disturbing question after you told him how depressed you were. What did he ask you?
That's a very hard question. That's a very hard story for me to tell, even though I tell it in the film. It's not easy because of the humiliation. He came into the room after I was undressed, and I guess I don't know why it's so important that when you're being admitted to a hospital, to a psychiatric ward, that you have to take off all your clothes. But that's what happened. And I was telling him about my medical history and the kind of medications I was on, and he really sort of interrupted me. He was standing behind me. I didn't see his face. And he suddenly asked me if I'd like to kiss my husband's penis. And, you know, it's been, 30 years or more. I remember to this day my feelings. It was like being stabbed in the back. And it's the kind of question that there's really no answer for in a situation like that. I was so torn about what to say. I absolutely did not know how to answer him.
What did you say?
Ultimately, I said sometimes, because it went through my mind very quickly if what would happen, what he might think if I said yes, and what he might think if I said no. And so I tried to save myself the best way I could by saying.
Do you have a clue why he asked you that?
I think he was titillated by the fact that he was in this room with this woman with no clothes on, that he was probably looking at me from behind, that I was very young and the power was very one-sided in the room, and that it was a titillating question to him, and he thought he could get away with it because it wasn't the kind of question that evolves out of a series of questions that you might be asked about your sex life or about how you're functioning or anything. It just came out of the blue.
Did the hospital help?
Not really. I guess it helped in two ways. It helped that I wasn't alone and that somebody was watching me and that I was not in danger of hurting myself. I learned how to play volleyball on Thorazine. That's the only thing I remember.
That's a useful skill.
To this day, I can't stand to watch people play volleyball.
Let me ask you to tell the JFK story about when you were in the hospital.
I was in the hospital in 1963, and I was coming back. And what happens is that you have a therapist on the ward who takes you to his office, and you have your therapy session there. And we were coming back from that therapy session, and a young man ran down the hall, and he was shouting, and he had pulled a telephone out of the wall, and he was holding the receiver in with the trailing cord. And when he saw the doctor with whom I was walking, he began to shout to him that the president is dead, the president has been killed. And the doctor's first thought was to turn to me and say, don't pay any attention to him, he's just hallucinating. And that was the assassination of John Kennedy. And all those years later, I thought to myself that he couldn't even believe this. I mean, he didn't have it in him to believe the story that was being presented to him because of the person who was telling it to him, someone who was certified and incarcerated. And so even when you tell the truth, sometimes it seems like a delusion to the person who's in charge, who has the power there.
Do you see your film as an indictment against psychiatrists and mental institutions?
I see the film as much of a true story as I could tell, and I think that that's what we try to do as artists and filmmakers, is to tell the truth. But I think that what people remember after they see the film is my story about the admitting doctor, or Dee Dee's story about the therapist who molested her. They may not as easily remember that another woman was really saved by her therapist, and another woman who had a bad therapist then got a good therapist who did help her. So I tried to be as balanced as I could.
When you were in an institution, this was in the pre-feminist era. And I think that really figures into your experience a lot.
Figures into the kind of assignments and the kind of things that I was told by the doctor who later treated me at Langley Porter.
Yes. To tell us, for instance, like what he wanted you to do when he was going to let you out for a
brief
period.
Well, he gave me assignments. Mm-hmm. And the first assignment was that I could go home on the weekend if I would bake a turkey. And I did that. And I did the other assignments. Another one was to go home and mop all the floors in my house. And I know now that he was trying to fit me back into a situation from which I was trying to escape. But I didn't know that at the time. I thought that he was doing his best to get me back on my feet. And so I tried to follow his instructions. And I did those things. And I hoped it was making me better. And that's as enlightened as I was at the time.
What's it like for you to look back on that period when you felt trapped by your life and didn't really know if you'd be able to find a way out of it?
Well, you know, sometimes I think I understand it better, and sometimes I think I'm not sure. All the pieces are still not there. But a few years later, when I really discovered feminism, it was like my eyes opened wider than they've ever opened in my life, and I saw, it's not that there were instant answers, but that suddenly I understood my life in a way that I hadn't before. It was very eye-opening, and made a tremendous change in my life.
My guest is Ellie Light, director of the new documentary Dialogues with Mad Women. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ellie Light, director of the new documentary Dialogues with Mad Women. In this excerpt, one of the women interviewed in the film, Hannah, describes her condition.
The common diagnosis is manic depression. What got me on the lithium then, when I was back down into the depression, was Quentin Bell's biography of Virginia Woolf, right? And I see her through her life go up and down and up and down. And then in 65 she was, or 62? I mean, so late in her life, she sticks the stones in her pockets and walks into the lake. And I said, aha, that's not happening to me. I am not going to kill myself unless I decide I want to do it. I'm not going to have these depressions make me do something against my will, because I don't feel like the depressions are me. I feel like I'm taken over by something. So that very day when I finished the book, I had a therapist appointment. When I went to see him, I said, okay, I'll take the lithium, you know, fine, which he had offered to me when I was high. And I took a lithium in the office, and I took a bunch home with me. And when I got back to the house, I sat down on the couch. I fell asleep. I was so depressed. Everything was great. And when I woke up from the nap, there was like a little spot of blue in the sky. I mean, really not very much, but just enough to know that the lithium worked. And I'd realized that each depression, the thoughts of suicide were growing. And then, of course, that I continued in my life to have these kinds of depressions. Then eventually I could end up like Virginia Woolf and walk into the lake with the stones in my pocket, which I didn't want to do. The thing that's hard about it is that I do believe in these non-ordinary realities. There's something trying to emerge. And it feels intensely alive, which is why it's so hard to give up. And it's so imaginative.
Now, how did you find the women who you interviewed in your movie?
They were all friends of mine. At some point in my life, I knew most of them for a long time. Two of them were students of mine. There were women who heard my story in the class and told me their stories. Hannah, the woman who, I call her the woman who loves Bob Dylan. She was my student.
She's a manic depressive who was just absolutely obsessed with Bob Dylan.
But I love her so much, and she has the sweetest spirit and the most determination of anybody I know to try to keep her life on an even keel, and that's very hard when you have these tremendous ups and downs.
There's something that Hannah says. She's the woman who's manic depressive and obsessed with Bob Dylan that I thought was very telling. You know, she's a terrific storyteller, and she holds the camera awfully well. But she says at one point, you know, I'm perfectly charming for an evening, but try living with me and you'll see what it's really about. And I thought, yeah. I mean, I really understood what she was talking about.
She has a lot of insight into herself.
Yeah, because she's also the person who described in the most disturbing way her fear that she'd be alone all her life, that she'd never find her, quote, soulmate. And that the agony of thinking of a life alone was so great, she thought she would kill herself if she didn't believe that maybe sometime in the future she would meet the right person.
And she begins that sentence by saying that that she bought the romantic ideal lock, stock, and barrel so that she can also stand outside and say, well, this is a romantic image, and maybe such a thing as a soulmate does or doesn't exist, but it doesn't matter whether it does or doesn't. I want one. I need one.
Your film ends on a very disturbing note that was obviously something you couldn't possibly have planned for. A woman named Karen, a Chinese-American woman who you interview in the movie, who was in, you know, she tells about the discrimination she faced growing up and about joining radical groups when she got older and, you know, the depression that she went through, how the radical groups kind of kicked her out after that. And her last words were about how at this point in her life she really wanted to be alive. And then the viewer finds out shortly afterwards that before the movie was completed, she was raped and murdered. Do you have any idea what happened?
Well, I know that it had what happened to her had nothing to do with her previous life. That it was a matter of being stalked by someone and murdered, not because she had once been on Thorazine and had the life that she talked about. Karen and I met when we both joined the Writers Union. And I loved her very much. She was my friend, and she was actually the first person I talked about making the film with. She was the associate producer. Her job was with the San Francisco Opera as a fundraiser. So although she had never done film before, we thought we could work together. She could raise money and all. And she's the first person I called when we got our first grant. And so it was horrible. It was horrible to find out what had happened and to get a call early in the morning about what had happened, that she had been murdered. And so I couldn't do any work at all on the film for almost a year. I just cried about her and had dreams about her trying to save her and all the things that you do when somebody that you care about dies. And I finally began by looking at the material by shutting the sound off and just looking at the picture and looking at her, all the footage, because it was a 2.5-hour interview with her. And then when I could do that, then I could turn on the sound, and then Irving and I could get back to work on the editing of the piece.
I have a question about your movie and watching the women talk about their lives. I was wondering if you were making the assumption at all that their problems, their depression, self-mutilation and things like that were caused by sexism and racism and social pressures.
I didn't start out with any notions or ideas about what the film was going to do. I think I work in an intuitive or maybe a more unconscious way. I wanted to get the stories down first, and so they were very long, the interviews. I certainly didn't set out to make a film about child sexual abuse, and look what happened. I mean, 4 out of the 7 women were sexually molested as children, but that wasn't what the film was about. Mm. It just happened that's the way our lives went. Neither my partner or I do anything like market research to talk to a lot of people and then decide who's going to be in the film. There were only the 6 women besides myself that I knew from the beginning were going to be part of the film. So the film is the way it turned out, the way it is, but there was nothing that I started out to do.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ellie Light's new documentary, Dialogues with Mad Women, shows tomorrow night at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Next month, it opens theatrically in 30 cities. This is Fresh Air.